And good afternoon or good evening, wherever you happen to be. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, 2 hours of Q&A coming your way on this Friday. I am Jerry Usher in for Cy Kella today. Blessed and honored to be here for Cy, who does such a great job hosting the program. And it is, like I said, a bonus question and answer open forum today at 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin is here the first hour. Mark Brumley scheduled for hour number two. Again, it's 888-318-7884. You know the drill. If you're a new listener, our Q&A open forums are basically you can ask anything you want about the Catholic faith, non-Catholic Christian faiths. You can ask about non-Christian religions. Jimmy Akin is knowledgeable in all of these areas and much, much more. So start dialing now. Phone lines are actually filling up already at 888-31-TRUTH. Hey, Jimmy, how are you?
Doing just fine. How are you, Jerry?
I am doing pretty well. It's Easter season. Lent couldn't end soon enough for me, and I'm glad Easter is here. How's your Easter season going?
It's going very well.
Good, good.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we got calls already, Jimmy, but if there's anything you want to alert people to before we take them, you can do that.
Nope. Let's take calls.
All right. Let's dive in right away. Here's the number again, 888-318-7884. Let's end the week with some great calls and questions, 2 hours of them coming your way right now, starting with Ryan in Washington. Hello, Ryan. Welcome to Catholic Answers Live and with Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Jimmy. Can you hear me?
Yes. What's your question?
Okay. My question today is pertaining to, well, I've noticed statistically a lot with people my age and increasingly across America, there is the rise of something known as the secular pro-life movement.
Mm-hmm.
However, I don't even think they are opposed to abortion, not because of religious reasons, but because it's scientifically proven that life begins at conception. However, these same people also support homosexuality, gay marriage, as well as assisted suicide or physician-assisted suicide. So my question is, how would Catholics respond to this? How would we work with these type of people, and how would we go about our business with them?
Well, so there are a couple of general principles here. One of them is you want to work with people where you can. And so if they're willing to, you know, help support pro-life candidates, pro-life laws, pro-life policies, then we want to work with them on those things. Obviously, we can't work with them on things that contradict the Christian faith, but we want to work with them where we can. The second principle is we want to share the good news with everybody so that they can have more joy both in this life and the next life. And so we want to look for opportunities to help draw them closer to God. And that may not mean immediately approaching them on the subjects where they're wrong. It may be more basic than that. It may involve, you know, helping them know about Jesus and God and the benefits that we receive as Christians from being close to Jesus and to God. And then at some point, you know, obviously they'll need to have views that are not compatible with the Christian faith. They'll need to have those corrected, but those aren't necessarily the starting point. In the case of some individuals, those may be the starting points. It's going to be a judgment call. There's no one-size-fits-all approach here. But in general, we want to work with people where we can, and we want to evangelize people and through one means or another, help them grow closer to God and help them grow closer to the Christian view of things.
Okay,
Ryan.
And yes, I do agree with you on that. I wouldn't like to call them true pro-lifers either, because in my opinion, if somebody supports physician-assisted suicide but they're opposed to abortion, in my point of view, that's just anti-abortion, not truly pro-life.
Well, I understand that point of view, but frankly, I wouldn't squabble with them over terms, because the squabbling, the effort that's put towards squabbling could be better put to other uses, like actually protecting children from abortion. You run the risk if you start picking at people and saying, ooh, you're not sufficiently pro-life in this one area, it tends to distract and it can alienate them and it can harm efforts to do actual concrete good in the world. The same thing happens in other contexts where, you know, in years past, people would say things like, "Ooh, if you're not anti-death penalty, then you're not really pro-life." And a lot of ink got spilled on that and similar subjects. And rather than quarrel about words, which St. Paul more than once warns us against because he says it ruins the hearers, rather than quarrel about words, I would focus on practical realities where we can cooperate.
Okay, Ryan, thanks for getting us started here on this Friday Q&A on Catholic Answers Live. Feel free to call anytime you have a question. Sue is next in Columbus, Ohio, listening on St. Gabriel Radio. Hi, Sue. Thanks for your call.
Hi. Yeah, I had a question about receiving communion.
Mm-hmm.
If a Protestant comes to a Catholic service and receives communion, unknowing that you're not supposed to do that unless you're Catholic and you've been through confession and, you know, you're prepared to receive the Eucharist. I mean, obviously you can rectify that by becoming Catholic, by going through the confession and preparing yourself to, but I know there's a scripture that says don't take communion.
What's your question for me, Sue?
Well, just that. What happens or how is that rectified? If the person has taken communion, but they haven't gone through confession.
Well, if the person is genuinely in good conscience, then even though they shouldn't be doing this, then God is not going to hold them accountable for that, just like God doesn't hold anybody accountable for something they do innocently. And since they would presumably be doing it if they're, you know, a Protestant, if they're a Christian, they're presumably doing this out of a desire to please God and grow closer to God, then God would recognize that. And even though they shouldn't have done it, that doesn't stop God from giving them his grace. In fact, the common opinion theologically, it would be that they receive sanctifying grace through that. And if they have mortal sins that they haven't confessed, but they're otherwise in good conscience and they receive the Eucharist, they would be forgiven those. The same thing is true of the common opinion of Catholics who, let's say you've forgotten a mortal sin and so you didn't remember to confess it, or you've committed it since your last confession, but you've forgotten about it, so you don't realize that you need to confess it. Well, according to the common opinion of Catholic theologians historically, like Thomas Aquinas, they would say that when you receive communion, innocently unaware of the fact that you should have gone to confession first, that because you're receiving innocently, God will nevertheless give you his grace, and actually you'll receive sanctifying grace in that moment, and you'll be forgiven for the mortal sin that you've forgotten about. You still, once you remember it, you need to go to confession about it, but it wouldn't stop you from receiving God's grace in that moment. And the same thing would apply to anyone else who's a baptized Christian that receives communion innocently, unaware of the fact that they need to do something else first, like go to confession or become a Catholic or whatever it may be.
What do you think, Sue? Is that okay?
Right. Well, I did just that. I received communion, found out after the fact that that was just for Catholics. It's not necessarily an open table like some churches I've been in, and I did not. As far as I know, my heart was right with God as much as I know to do, but I am exploring the Catholic faith now since I've been listening to Catholic Answers. And
awesome.
But that bothered me.
Yeah. Well, from a Catholic point of view, if you received innocently and were trying to please God, then that it did please God, even though objectively, shouldn't have done that. But it wouldn't have stopped you from receiving God's grace. And praise God that you're looking at becoming a Catholic. We're here to help you out anytime we can, okay?
All right, Sue, we'll be praying for you. And as Jimmy said, Catholic Answers is here not only on the radio program, but you can call and speak with someone anytime you'd like off the air at greater length during a business hours, 9 to 5-ish, Monday through Friday, Pacific time, at 619-387-7200. Open forum on a Friday here, Jimmy Akin, followed by Mark Brumley. So, Beth, you're next. We've got Sandy in Boise, Nick, Mark, Christina, all of your calls we're going to get to with Jimmy Akin when we come back. I just want to let people know, Jimmy, about the store-wide sale that's going on, and this, of course, includes many of your items as well. You've got some new things, do you, or do you have anything brand new?
Well, my most recent book that's come through the press is Teaching with Authority. Also just had a 5-CD debate set that I did with Steve Gregg come out. So that's called Aiken versus Gregg, and I think that's available now as well.
Okay. It's the store-wide sale. Annual spring sale is now underway at Catholic Answers. New resources by Jimmy, by Don Eden, by Trent Horn, many, many more. There's a promo code we want to have you use, and that's code SPRING19 at checkout, and you'll save 15% off the entire store at Catholic.com, including all books, DVDs, and CDs by Jimmy Akin. And again, it's just a vast array, and they are all either produced by Catholic Answers or thoroughly vetted for their faithfulness and their dynamism. So stop by Catholic.com and take advantage of this store-wide sale for spring. The code again is SPRING19. Use that code at checkout.
Call and ask Jimmy your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live is proudly supported by CatholicChemistry.com, a new dating site for Catholics who want to do dating right and believe relationships start with Catholic chemistry. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicChemistry.com for their generous support on the web at CatholicChemistry.com.
Homeschool Connections, an online provider of courses for your Catholic homeschool, is a sponsor of Catholic Answers Live. Homeschool Connections website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Morning Glory. It's Catholic from coast to coast.
So I just thought this was a great story to talk about the periodic table. Again, to me, it points us to God and that we should not be afraid of science, but we should embrace it.
Yeah. Well, Scientist Purvis, thank you so much for taking us to class today.
They should name a chemical after you.
Like something combustible.
Yeah, really.
Morning Glory. Talking about everything important to today's Catholic. Monday morning, 7 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Happy to answer your apologetics and faith questions on Catholic Answers Live. In for Cy Kellett, I'm Jerry Usher, just pleased to be here. And Jimmy Akin, the senior apologist at Catholic Answers, is taking your questions and giving the always great answers. And as promised, we're going to resume with Beth in Covington, Louisiana. Beth, thank you for calling Catholic Answers Live.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm interested in knowing what happens to the sacrament of matrimony, the grace you receive when you get married, if an annulment occurs 21 years later.
Nothing happens to it in principle. If you were genuinely sacramentally married, then you received the grace of the sacrament at the time that you were married, and so an annulment doesn't reach back in time and change history. It would also mean that the annulment in this case was false, because what an annulment is designed to do is look at a situation and reach a legal finding of whether the initial marriage was valid or not. And if you and the party you married were both baptized, then it would have automatically been a sacramental marriage if it was valid, and so you would have received the grace of the sacrament. And a later finding of nullity would be an erroneous finding that wouldn't do anything to whether you received sacramental grace at the time of the initial marriage. Also, now, one could say, okay, in addition to the grace that one received at the time the marriage was contracted, you also may receive grace on an ongoing basis through living out your marital vows. And even though you're not currently living with your spouse as a result of the divorce and the annulment that followed it, if you're otherwise still faithful to your vows, then you would continue to receive grace in the same way, even though you're expressing that faithfulness to your vows in a new form.
Well, I was married for 21 years. I was 100% sure I was marrying him, marrying the right man. I was very honest through the whole annulment process, and now it has been annulled. And I was just curious. So are you saying my annulment isn't valid?
No, I would assume your annulment is valid. I would say, and I not having seen the casework, I don't know what grounds they cited as reasons for nullity, and it may have had nothing to do with you. You may have married in good conscience and done everything you needed to do in order to properly marry the gentleman you married, but the problem that prevented the marriage from being valid may have been on his part. It may have been something that he did. So I can't assess the reasons for the nullity, but generally, just like it's a bad idea to self-diagnose yourself with medical conditions, it's also a bad idea to self-diagnose annulments or to self-diagnose marriage validity. This is a very complex matter that involves expert judgment that most of us do not have, and that's why it's left to qualified experts to serve as tribunal officials in evaluating marriage cases. So I would say that you should assume that the annulment was valid and was accurate, and consequently you can proceed on the assumption that your initial marriage, even though you may have entered it in good conscience, for one reason or another, didn't end up becoming valid at the time it was contracted.
Okay, Beth?
Thank you so much.
You're no problem. Welcome. And like I said, it has nothing to do with you necessarily. I mean, it's not saying you're at fault or anything like that. In fact, neither party may be at fault. It's just for one reason or another, the tribunal judged that something happened at the time the marriage was contracted that prevented it from coming into existence.
Okay, thanks again for the call, Beth. Appreciate that. We're going to go from Covington, Louisiana to Boise, Idaho. Salt and Light Radio is how Sandy is listening to Catholic Answers Live. Hi, Sandy.
Hi, thank you for your work, and God bless you. Question, is it true, or where can I find resources that that say that when our Lord died, you know how there were earthquakes and the earth went dark and all that, that there were actually people coming out of their graves?
Mm-hmm. This is mentioned in one place in the Bible. It's in Matthew chapter 27, and that's really our primary source for this. We do find some later mentions of this, but they're all commentaries on Matthew, so we really don't have independent attestation of this. We're dependent on Matthew for this fact. So that's the real starting place.
Okay. Thank you, Jimmy.
No problem.
Thanks, Sandy. All right. Nick is in Texas watching on YouTube Live. Hi, Nick. You're on with Jimmy Akin. Go for it.
Hello. I had a first quick question before my actual question. Is the Eucharist and the body of the Eucharist and the Lord of Christ a means of salvation?
I'm sorry, Nick, you're real fuzzy. Can you speak directly into your phone, please?
Yes. Is the Eucharist and the blood of Christ a means of salvation?
Yes, they are, in that they are one of the means by which God communicates his grace to us. That's not to say that there aren't other things that are also means of salvation. In fact, in order to even be able to receive the Eucharist, one needs to be baptized first. And so, consequently, it's not the first sacrament of Christian initiation, and it's not the only sacrament that of Christian initiation, but as one of the sacraments, it is a means by which God communicates his grace to us, and so in that sense, it is a means of salvation.
Okay, and so then with that, at my church, the priest only gives out the Eucharist. I don't know if he doesn't give out the blood of Christ, maybe for sanitary reasons. Mm-hmm. But I guess my question was, do they have the same value? Am I missing out if I only receive the bread?
You are not missing out on anything if you only receive the host. All of Jesus Christ is present under both forms. So all of Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity is present in the host. All of Jesus Christ, body, blood, soul, and divinity is present in the precious blood. And while it's more expressive to receive in both forms, you are receiving all of Jesus Christ under only one form. So you are not missing out on any grace that God wants you to have.
Okay, Nick?
Okay.
Awesome. Thank you for the call. 888-318-7884. Catholic Answers Live, known for many, many things on this program, topics, spirituality, theology, apologetics, and a couple of times a week, Tuesday and Thursday, and also today a bonus question and answer, open forum. So you're free to ask whatever you'd like of Jimmy Akin this hour, 888-318-7884. There is that one line that is open there. It'll go fast, though. And we're going to go to Alliance, Ohio. Mark, listening on Living Bread Radio. Hi, Mark. You're on with Jimmy Akin.
Well, hello, guys. Great show, as always. It's you guys are doing great work educating us Catholics and non-Catholics in this world.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I got a question for Jimmy. Jimmy, can you recommend any resources for studying the first five books of the Bible, primarily Genesis, giving, say, a historical perspective, maybe Jewish or Catholic or non-Catholic commentary on what was occurring at that time or what we believe might have occurred at the time, what life was like beyond what the Bible tells us?
So there's a huge literature that's associated with all of this. There are lots and lots and lots of books that deal with exactly those sorts of questions. One of my favorites, and it's not specifically about the book of Genesis and the first five books of the Bible. It's more about Israel's history as a whole, but it does go into the way people lived and the different social institutions and how they worked. It's called Ancient Israel, Its Life and Institutions, and it's by a Dominican scholar named Roland DeVaux, D-E, new word, V-A-U-X, Roland DeVaux. And he was an archaeologist. He was one of the guys who was involved early on in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And his book is one of my favorites as an overview of how ancient Israelite society worked. There are a lot of other things. If you wanted the Jewish Publication Society, they're kind of expensive, but the Jewish Publication Society has what's called the JPS Torah Commentary, which is quite good. There are lots of Christian commentaries on the Pentateuch. There are even introductions to the Pentateuch. A course on Genesis in particular that I can recommend is put out by The Great Courses, also known as The Teaching Company. It's an audio course, although I believe they have a video version of it too. And it's by a Jewish scholar named Gary Rendsburg, R-E-N-D-S-B-U-R-G-H, I believe it might be E-R-G-H. But Gary Rendsburg's commentary on Genesis, his course on Genesis is very good. There are a variety of different kind of background books that deal with the, what else was going on in the world at the time. If you just search on like Old Testament backgrounds, you'll run across things like that. Another book, I haven't read it myself, but it's quite popular. It's called Manners and Customs of Bible Times. You might want to check that out. And one of the things you'll find if you start digging into this is there's a debate among scholars about the degree to which different things in the Old Testament are literal and historically reliable versus how much reconstruction is going on. There's no single opinion on that. You have scholars who range from the very literal, some of them too literal, to those who are way at the other extreme. And a kind of helpful book in that regard might be The Reliability of the Old Testament by Kenneth Kitchen, just like you, the place where you make your food, Kenneth Kitchen. He's an Old Testament scholar, an archaeologist, an Egyptologist, and he has mounted a significant defense of the historical reliability of the Old Testament. So that might be one you also want to check out.
There was mention of a Flavian Josephus that was an ancient or an Israel
right
philosopher or theologian. Is that somebody that would be someone that would be a good source as well?
Josephus is an important source. He lived in the late first century. He was born around the year AD 37, so just after the time of Jesus. And he wrote several works. The two major ones are he wrote a history of the Jewish war that occurred in the AD 60s. He was a general in that war. He also wrote a book called Jewish Antiquities, which covers the whole of Jewish history. And it repeats a lot of what's in the Old Testament, but then it goes further. He's considered an important historical source. He's not always reliable.
He's kind of self-aggrandizing at times, too. When you read his history of the Jewish War, it's really clear he's slanting things in his own favor. But he is an important historical source. But I would suggest if you really want to learn about the first five books of the Bible, Josephus is not the first place you want to go. You want to look at more modern scholarship.
Okay, great. Hey, I appreciate that information.
By the way, something that might be of assistance to you, the Ignatius Study Bible will have good popular level commentary on the first five books of the Bible. So you might want to check that out. That might be a good, easy entryway into the subject.
All right, Mark, nice to hear from you there in Alliance, Ohio. And we have Christina, who is in Massachusetts, listening on Emmanuel Radio when we come back. And Marcos in San Jose, Claire, Ian, Ryan, and we have an open phone line, 888-318-7884. I'm Jerry Usher in for Cy Kellett, and Jimmy Akin is here this hour answering your questions, to be followed by Mark Brumley. By the way, you can catch me and Debbie Giorgiani, my co-host, Take Two with Jerry and Debbie. Weekdays at noon Eastern time and a replay at midnight Eastern on many of these EWTN stations. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back with more Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can book any of our great speakers to speak at your parish or special event? Contact one of our seminar coordinators through the Speakers Bureau section on Catholic.com today to find out more information.
Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do you say that I am?" Turns out that today, as back then, this question has a lot of different answers. So many groups want to appropriate Jesus, tweaking his identity until he looks and sounds just like one of them. But then you no longer have the Lord, says apologist Trent Horn. You have an imposter. In his new groundbreaking book, Counterfeit Christ, Trent exposes 18 phony versions of Jesus that we encounter today, helping you to recognize the fakes when you see them, explain why they're phony, and make a case for the full truth and beauty of who Jesus is, the Christ, the Son of the living God. Order your copy of Counterfeit Christ today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Love and beauty. As a little girl, Dawn Eden Goldstein knew that she wanted those things, that in them somehow she would find God. Over the years as a rock journalist, she moved among some of popular music's best-known artists, straining to capture that transcendent love and beauty in every note and lyric. In Sunday Will Never Be the Same, Dawn recounts her spiritual journey in beautifully wrought detail, mixing powerful accounts of trauma, healing, and epiphany with funny anecdotes from inside the music scene. It is the rare conversion story that delights as it inspires, amuses as it edifies, and ultimately lays before the reader a lived testimony to the transforming grace of Christ. Order your copy of Sunday Will Never Be the Same by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
And we're heading into the weekend, but you can always listen to Catholic Answers Live archives at Catholic.com. And you can also sign up for the podcast there as well. I'm Jerry Usher with Jimmy Akin this hour. First hour of two of a Q&A open forum here on Friday. And next up, as promised, Christina listens on Emmanuel Radio in Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Christina. You're on with Jimmy.
Hey, how are you guys doing today? Jimmy, I have a little situation here.
Okay.
I have an 11-year-old nephew. He was baptized, but they don't practice the Catholic faith. And we were discussing today about the devil and God. Mm-hmm. Now, he is a child who has not seen the devil but believes in the devil, but does not believe in God. How do I explain to him that there is a God?
Well, my inclination would be to ask him some questions. One of them would be, well, where do you think the devil came from? And where do you think the whole world came from, for that matter? There needs to be a creator. If there is going to be a creation, and if there, even though the devil is only a finite or limited evil, one would expect there to be at least an equally powerful and actually more powerful good that the devil is opposing. If you read in the Bible about what the devil does, just reading the Bible and the passages that talk about the devil and what he does, he's opposing God. He's opposing Jesus. And just some basic context from the Bible might help. You also might look through the passage in the Catechism that talk, or there's more than one, but the passages that talk about the creation of the angels and the demons who fell from being good angels into being bad ones. That would help provide some context for the whole concept of the devil and how it relates to God. To make it a little more real to him emotionally, I mean, if he thinks that there's a devil out there that can hurt people in various ways, well, that's a pretty scary thing. And one would want there to be an even greater good to protect one from what the devil's trying to do. And so that might help him on an emotional level to think it through emotionally. I'd also ask his reasons for, well, if you believe in the devil but not God, why? What's the – because normally, you know, people – normally it's the other way around. Normally if people – they may believe in God but not the devil – you very seldom find someone who believes in the devil but not God. What leads you to conclude that? And then I would look at the reasons he proposes for that. There may be some barriers that he's laboring under mentally that are preventing him from seeing the logic of if devil, therefore God. And you may need to clear away some of those barriers.
Okay, because he said to me today, well, if I, the only way I would believe in God is if he was standing right in front of me. So I said, well, if you don't see the devil, so how, you know, you'd have to believe in him if he was standing right in front of you.
Right. What did he say to that?
I have to really go and get the catechism and explain this to him.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't go to church. They're not Catholic. It's hard for them to understand.
Right.
And I feel so bad. But at least I have some suggestions on how to approach this.
Yeah. Also, just to say another word about the principle he's employing of I would only believe in God if he was standing right in front of me. Well, there are a number of potential problems with that. One of them is if you really applied that principle consistently, then you wouldn't believe in Abraham Lincoln. You wouldn't believe in any – you wouldn't believe in, you know, a person living 5 miles away from you who you've never seen. And what makes the devil an exception to that rule? And, you know, the devil doesn't have a physical body. God doesn't have, apart from the incarnation, doesn't have a physical body. And so if you can believe in the devil, even though he can't, you know, physically appear in front of you, why do you have trouble with God doing the same thing?
All right, Christine, I hope that helps. So you can always go to Catholic.com, or again, you can call the Apologist line too if you ever need further help with that or anything else. 619-387-7200. All right, we're going to go to San Jose, California. Marcos, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hi, Marcos. Good to have you with us.
Hi, thanks for having me. My question is, what does the Catholic Church teach on cannibalism in the scenario that you're stranded and you're out of food and all that's left is like a corpse?
Okay.
And scenario B, the person before they died told you they'd like you to eat them. That way you have something to eat.
Okay. As far as I'm aware, the Catholic Church doesn't have a teaching on this. The Catholic Church does have a teaching that the bodies of the dead are to be treated with respect. But what that means varies depending on the on a variety of factors, including the wishes of the deceased. That's why, for example, if someone, even though it's not the norm, if someone wishes that their remains be cremated, well, then as long as they're not doing it for reasons opposed to the faith, then the church would say, okay, in this case, the way we're honoring this person's remains is by fulfilling their request to be cremated. And observing the other, you know, rites that need to be observed when a person is cremated in the Catholic Church. Because the situation that you're proposing is so extreme, I'm not aware of any church document that addresses it. Obviously, there are mentions of cannibalism in the Bible and in Christian history, and it's always viewed as a tragedy whenever it happens, but there's not a condemnation of this must not happen. You have to allow yourself to starve to death in such situations. And so because it's something that the church doesn't have a teaching on, I would say you're going to have to do your best if you ever find yourself in such a situation to apply the principles of Catholic moral theology as best you understand them and trust God with the outcome. One factor that's also relevant here is even if somebody makes a mistake, if you're truly in a condition of starvation where you will die unless you eat the body of a comrade, then you're under severe physical and mental distress. And that may end up, even if you made the wrong decision, it would tend to diminish your responsibility for it, because if you're under physical and mental duress when you make a bad decision, God takes that into account and realizes this isn't a freely made choice. The person was acting under these very difficult factors.
Okay, Marcos?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Glad we could help you with that, Marcos. Anytime, you can call from San Jose. And we go to Omaha next. Spirit Catholic Radio is where Claire is listening to Catholic Answers Live. Hello, Claire. You get to go next with Jimmy.
Hello.
Hi, Claire. Hello. What's your question?
My question is about something I heard in grade school. I'm in high school now.
Uh-huh.
But when I was in grade school and I had religion class, I was told that the word Catholic means to be open to everyone. So I have a question about why are we so open? I mean, that probably sounds horrible when I say it like that, but...
Well, no, I would say a few things here. I don't know who your religion teacher was, and I obviously wasn't there in the class, so I didn't hear what was said. But if your religion teacher said the word Catholic means being open to everyone, then your religion teacher was wrong. That's not what the word Catholic means. The word Catholic comes from a Greek phrase that originally meant according to the whole, and it came to mean universal. And then from there it became the name of the universal church that Jesus founded. And so its meaning has developed over the course of time, but even today it retains the sense of universality, that the church is meant to preach to everybody and meant to do its best to help everybody grow closer to God. And so that does entail or result in a kind of openness to everybody. There's no group of people that if they believe the gospel and they repent and they want to become Catholic, the church is not going to say, sorry, you can't. The church, by Christ's mandate, it's right there in the very last verses of Matthew's gospel. Jesus says, preach the gospel to all the nations and make disciples from them. And so the church has this universal mission, and that implies being open to everybody, not just Jews, not just Greeks, not just Britons, not just Russians, not just Ugandans, but everybody is someone that Jesus died for and that he wants us to share the gospel with. And so in that sense, we do need to be open to everybody. That does not mean, though, that we need to be open to every single thing about people. People have sometimes mistaken ideas. And while we want to be, you know, reasonable and understanding when someone has a mistaken idea, that doesn't mean we accept the mistaken idea. One of the things Jesus said, again, right there in the closing verses of Matthew's gospel when he gave the Great Commission, he said, go into all the nations and make disciples, teaching them everything I have commanded you. And so if someone has an idea that is in conflict with what Jesus taught us, then we need to say, well, I understand that's what you think right now, but as a Christian, I follow what Jesus taught, and this is what Jesus taught. And so we don't need to be borrow a phrase, we don't need to be so open that our brains fall out. We need to be open-minded in the sense of being thoughtful and reasonable, but we don't need to be open-minded in the sense that we betray our Christian faith by failing to to hold the teachings that Jesus gave us. Because as Christians, he's the Son of God. He's God's voice to us. And so we need to accept what Jesus tells us in the name of God. So we do want to be open to everyone, and we want to share the message of Jesus with everyone, and we want them to grow closer to God. But we don't want to be so open that we forget to be faithful to Jesus first.
Okay, Claire, how does that sound?
That sounds great. Thank you so much.
No problem.
All right, keep up your diligent inquisitiveness on the Catholic faith, Claire. We appreciate that. We're going to take our final break in this first hour right now. So Ian and Ryan and Aurelio and Mark and Chris, hold on. We got a lot more time this hour and next with Jimmy Akin, followed by Mark Brumley on this Friday Q&A open forum on Catholic Answers Live. Hey, I am excited to tell you folks about this, the Fullness of Truth Conference. If you live in the Fort Worth area or really anywhere within driving distance or flying distance, if you want to come in, Catholic Answers is bringing a conference with Tim Staples, Trent Horn, and Carlo Broussard to your town next weekend. Again, it's the Fort Worth area. It's the Fullness of Truth Conference, and it's titled Catholic for a Reason, Scriptural Roots of Catholic Teaching. Now, we need you to come out in droves. Don't come alone. Bring some friends, some fellow parishioners.
Bring droves.
Bring droves, yeah. bring some family members, bring your prayer group, whatever. Tim Staples, Trent Horn, and Carla Broussard. Again, it's May 10th and 11th, so it's really a two-day event at Good Shepherd Catholic Community. That's located at 1000 Tinker Road in Colleyville, Texas. And if you'd like more information or to register, go to fullnessoftruth.org. You will not regret going to this event.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
The prayers of the elderly are powerful. Why? Because you learn in old age to depend upon God. There's no one else. Because you are still made to the image and likeness of God, no matter how old you are. You're valuable to God. Don't let anybody tell you you're not.
For more information on Mother Angelica, visit Religious Catalog at EWTNRC.com.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
We're going to get to more of your calls now on Catholic Answers Live with Jimmy Akin and you and Ian in San Antonio, Texas, listening on Sirius XM 130. Hi, Ian. Thanks for waiting through the break there. Go ahead.
Howdy, y'all. So I just recently was confirmed and received the body and blood of the Eucharist for the first time this past Easter Vigil.
Uh-huh.
So, like, I'm kind of new again to, like, the confession stuff. And I just had a question about that because, so, like, when you go for the sacrament of confession, you know, I'm partially blind, so I can't really wipe these kind of, you know, when I, like, sin during the week, especially with sick. I remember most mm-hmm. of my sins, but,
uh-huh.
you know, if you go into confession and you confess your sins, at the end, because I, like, sometimes have forgotten stuff, I say, like, and I confess all, you know, all the sins that I have forgotten that I've neglected to mention because of my forgetfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so then the priest absolves me. And then, like, I, you know, like, today I went to confession and I forgot to confess something, but I did say, like, what I just said at the
right.
end. And the priest did absolve me.
Mm-hmm.
But since I remembered something else, you know, that I had done, you know, because I said, like, for all the sins that I forgot, you know, that I might be forgetting to confess, does that absolution still count for that sin, even though
yes.
I didn't necessarily mention it since I said anything that I confessed?
Yes. The only way it doesn't count is if you knowingly and deliberately withhold a sin. And say, I'm just not going to confess this. If you're doing your part to confess all of the grave sins, all the mortal sins that you remember, then even if you've forgotten a mortal sin, God knows your intention was to confess all of them, and so the absolution is going to be valid. If you then remember one afterwards, you can be thankful that the absolution was valid, and you then want to mention it at your next confession. You want to fulfill the intention you had of confessing all of your mortal sins by going on to confess this one now that you've remembered it.
Okay, and so, if you did commit a mortal sin that you neglected to mention, since you can't receive, you know, the Eucharist in a state of mortal sin, can you go and receive it if you do remember a mortal sin that you forgot to confess?
You are, after the absolution, you are not in a state of mortal sin, therefore you can go and receive communion.
Okay.
Even though you may have remembered something before you received communion, the absolution was valid. You're in a state of grace. You can go receive communion. Just be sure to mention the mortal sin that you forgot next time.
Okay, Ian?
Thank you so much.
No problem.
All right, very good. Appreciate your calling in so much. We're going to go to Ryan in Peoria, Illinois, listening on 94.3 FM. Ryan, we're glad that you called Catholic Answers Live, and you have a question for Jimmy Akin. Go for it.
Yeah, hey, so I'm a good old Protestant, and I had a question, and I come in peace, by the way.
Thank
and
you.
And so from an exegetical standpoint, what do you think, as a Protestant, what's the best passage from an exegetical or authorial intent perspective that I should consider that would challenge me being a Protestant in reference to considering becoming Catholic?
Well, it's not just a single passage, but I would say that if you really take a hard look at Matthew 16 and what Jesus says to Peter there and what the implications are about that for his church, because it's not just Peter. We can deduce, in addition to deducing some things about Peter, we can also deduce some things about Jesus's church from that passage. This is the famous, "You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church." And as a, when I was Protestant, I would argue against that and say, well, that's not what Jesus meant. He meant this other thing. But then I realized, no, there are structural factors in the text that require Peter to be the rock. But it's not only Peter being the rock that's significant. Jesus says, on this rock I will build my church. So there's one church. It's singular. And the gates of hell will not prevail against it. So it's going to never pass out of existence. It's never going to die. And so the one church that Jesus founded has to have continued for the last 2,000 years. The question is it a visible or an invisible church? A visible one being one that has leaders and rules and membership, and you can include or exclude people from it. An invisible church is one which it's just a spiritual union of people that doesn't really have a visible structure or a visible membership or visible rules that govern whether you're a member or not. And you look at the context, well, he then gives Peter the power of the keys, and that was a phrase in Judaism at the time that meant the ability to make laws. You look at the parallel passage in Matthew 18, he shares not the keys specifically, but the power to bind and loose with the other disciples, and it's in a context where he's talking about church discipline, and he says that, you know, if someone doesn't listen to the church, then treat them like a tax collector or a sinner. In other words, exclude them, treat them like a non-member. And so when you look at all that, he also appointed the apostles as leaders. So he's founding a single church that has leaders and laws and a discernible membership that people can be included or excluded from. And that means he's talking about a visible church. So if we want to identify Jesus's church today, we need to look for a visible church that has existed since the first century and that's founded on Peter. And that's the Catholic Church. That's kind of an overview because, you know, here on live radio, and we're getting near the end of the show, I don't have a lot of time to go into it. But what I'd recommend is if you just go online and search for my name, Jimmy Akin, A-K-I-N, and then type in "Why Be Catholic? An Exercise for Evangelicals," you'll find a paper on my personal website, jimmyakin.com, that I wrote a number of years ago specifically for an audience of Protestant seminarians they had me come in and give a talk on this. And so I did Why Be Catholic, an exercise for evangelicals. And I go into this and support the different points I just made exegetically.
Okay. Really quick, is there a – I always struggle with the Galatians 2 conflict.
Okay.
In light of Matthew 16.
Uh-huh.
Is there a good resource to read on that from a Catholic perspective?
You want to state what that is,
Jimmy? I've written a number of things on that. Google Jimmy Akin and Galatians 2 or Jimmy Akin and Paul Peter Antioch, and you should come across those. Also, I deal with that in I know I've written about it for Catholic Answers magazine at Catholic.com. There may be some stuff at JimmyAkin.com. I also covered that in my book, A Daily Defense. That's one of the 365 challenges I consider. Basically, what you have there is if you look in Galatians 1 and 2, you'll see that Peter is the example Paul keeps coming back to prove the supremacy of the gospel. And the reason he keeps coming back to Peter in Galatians 1 and 2 in his discussion is because Peter's the perfect test case for the supremacy of the gospel. He's concerned to show that the gospel is superior to any man, and what better way to do that than to show the gospel is even superior to Peter, the head of the church. And so when he rebukes Peter in Galatians 2, that's one of the ways he does that. It doesn't mean Peter doesn't have authority. It just means Peter made a mistake. Just like or at least in Paul's view, Peter made a mistake, just like Peter definitely made a mistake when he denied Jesus three times. But that didn't stop Jesus afterwards from telling him, feed my sheep.
OK, Ryan.
Awesome. Thank you.
No
problem. Very good. I think we have time for Aurelio in Richmond, California. I'm sorry if I got your name wrong, Aurelio, but we got about 3 minutes. You're watching on YouTube Live. Go ahead with Jimmy Akin. Hello, Aurelio. Are you there?
Hi. What's your question, Aurelio?
Yeah. Hi.
What is your question?
Go for it.
We're short on time.
Yeah. Sorry. First of all, I just want to say thank you guys for giving me the time to ask this question. I've been just recently converted to Catholicism. I've not proud of him, but I was non-denominational.
Aurelio, just so you know, we've got like 2 minutes left, and I want to give you the best answer I can. What's your question?
My question is, can you give me some, for either one of you, can you give me some scriptural evidence in the Bible that will help me understand transubstantiation? I cannot, it's hard for me to understand how.
Okay. So what I would suggest is, because of how short on time we are, I would suggest you go to Catholic.com and type in words like transubstantiation and Eucharist, and you'll find resources. We've got a lot of resources that are there for you online for free that you can read about this. Just to give you a little bit of a look at some of the Bible verses you'll read about, well, in each of the Gospels, in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, you have Jesus saying, "This is my body and this is my blood." He's not saying this symbolizes or this contains, but this is my body and blood. In John's gospel, in John 6, he's got an even more extended discussion of this. And rather than clarifying it for people when people challenge him on this and say – he doesn't say, oh, guys, come on. This is a symbol. It's like the leaven of the Pharisees. I'm using a symbol. Instead, he does the opposite. He ratchets up the firmness and is even willing to lose core disciples over this. He basically dares the core disciples to leave if they're not going to accept this. Also, we have in 1 Corinthians 10 and 11, Paul discusses the Eucharist and he talks about how it's a participation in the body of Christ and not just a symbol but an actual participation in the body of Christ. And consequently, if we receive it the wrong way, we'll be guilty of the body and blood of Christ, and there can be consequences for that. So those are some of the passages. Also, at Catholic.com, there's a document I wrote from the early church fathers, quoting the church fathers from the second century onward understanding the real presence. So go to Catholic.com, type in Eucharist, transubstantiation, terms like that, and you'll find a lot of resources.
Great, Aurelio. Thank you from Richmond, California, for your listenership and your call. Jimmy, great being with you again today.
Yeah, always a pleasure, Jerry.
Yep, Jimmy Akin, a senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. I am Jerry Usher. I'm sticking around for hour number two. Mark Brumley scheduled to join us. We hope that you can stay around as well, and I would appreciate if you would try and check out my program with Debbie Giorgiani. Take two with Jerry and Debbie, weekdays at noon Eastern on most of these EWTN stations. Stick around. If you're on the line, we're going to get to you. You will lead off in hour number two.